Darkcast Network. Welcome to the dark side of podcasts.
You have the power to see what is in the abuser's playbook. It's the cycle of abuse. Welcome back, you guys. My name is Tiffany, and I am your host of True Crime Connections. This week, we are uncovering the hidden truth of dating violence with Bill Mitchell. Bill is unfortunately no stranger to dating violence. His daughter, Kristen, was murdered by her boyfriend, and he is now determined to help save other lives. Hello and welcome. I want to thank you for being on the show tonight with me.
Yes, Tiffany. Thank you very much. It's really, it's a great thing to be asked to be on your show. Thank you. I'm looking forward to talking about a few things, making some points.
Yes, you have a story that needs to be heard by any parent or any high schooler, anybody who is dating. I'd like to say my apologies in losing your daughter, Kristen. But I think it's important that we talk about, you know, the legacy that you are now leaving behind, plus her story.
Yes, thank you very much. Do you want me to just go ahead and just roll right in?
Yeah, wherever you feel comfortable to start.
Absolutely. Our story picks up, for the most part, in May of 2005, which, for anybody listening to this, is practically 20 years ago. I realize that. But for somebody like me or people in my family, it's more like, it's not 20 years ago, it's 20 years of yesterdays, because it's always like it just happened. It's just like it was yesterday. It's not today, but it just happened. And that's a horrible thing, honestly, to not really shake it. So, you know, with that in mind, getting to what happened with Kristen, in May of 2005, she graduated from St. Joseph's University, which is outside of Philadelphia. And the day she graduated, she never looked more proud, more happy, more radiant, more with it. She already had won a job with General Mills. It wasn't some great big job, but it was a nice sales associate job. She was going to be starting in about a month from the graduation or so. And so we live outside of Baltimore. So we had to drive up there that day. It's about 125 miles. So my wife, my son, and I drove up to it, met up with Kristen. She went through her graduation with 800 other students, graduates, and afterwards met the boyfriend for the very first time. And my immediate impression of him, which was very strange, and I've never had anything like this before, my immediate impression of him was, wow, I'd never want to tangle with this guy.
Mm.
So here I am, shaking his hand, looking at him. I had no lead up to that at all. I wasn't warned, nothing. But I just thought, I was just picturing fighting this guy at some point. And I never felt that way about anybody my daughter dated, but that's exactly what I was thinking. So anyway, we stood around, took a bunch of pictures. I took pictures of Kristen and the boyfriend, who I'll call Nick, which is not his real name. It's the name I used in the book, and I've used it since that time. But we took pictures. They took pictures of us. You know, you could see our family of four. He took some pictures. And the following week, we actually had emails back and forth sharing pictures. So it was like this nice thing. The one hint that this relationship may not last was a phone call about a month before the graduation. And my wife was just asking about the relationship. And my daughter said, well, Mom, it's not the perfect relationship. And my wife took that as being not this big statement. She took it as being, well, I guess it's not going to last, and it's not the first boyfriend, and it won't be the last one, and you just don't pursue it. She sort of took it like that. Knowing what I know now, if I heard that from somebody, anybody, any person talking about the boyfriend, if they said, well, you know, it's not the perfect relationship, I would gently ask things like, well, why is that? I mean, can you tell me about that? Or I might say, well, okay, it's not the perfect relationship. what would be a perfect relationship? You may be going about it that way. You might start to learn, but be a little more inquisitive. But my wife did what I would have done back in those days, and she just took it as this will be over and turn the page, and that's that. Anyway, that was graduation day. 20 days later, it was June 3rd, 2005. It was a very rainy Friday, and I received a call late in the evening from local detectives who said they needed to meet with me and they needed to tell me something. Now, at that moment, nobody was at our house. My wife and son were at a graduation party for a high schooler, and I was with my parents, I guess about 25 minutes from home, when I got this call. So I didn't really know. It was a woman saying she was a police lieutenant detective. And I just thought, I don't know who this is on a dark and rainy night. So I decided to meet at a grocery store. I just figured, okay, well, she said, I need to tell you something. And I kept coming back to saying, well, tell me what? And she said, well, that's my point. I need to tell you something, but I can't tell you over the phone. So I thought, well, you know, I'm going to meet up with these people. Either they think I did something and I'm going to get arrested. Okay, but I didn't think of anything I did. Or something happened on our street and maybe they think I know something. I didn't know what it was. I called my wife, who was at that party I told you about, this graduation party. And I said something about, yeah, they want to meet with me. They need to tell me something. And she said, is it about Kristen? And I said, well, I don't think local detectives are here to talk with me about Kristen, who's 125 miles away. Well, that's what they were coming to talk with me about. So it was actually in front of a grocery store where the automatic doors are opening as people go in and out. And I picked that spot because I wasn't sure who really was going to show up. And I figured I'd be in a public place. But that's when I heard, Mr. Mitchell, I'm sorry to inform you, your daughter was murdered by her boyfriend today. And at that point, obviously, anyone's life's on a whole different trajectory. You know, and I knew it. I understood. I mean, I knew it. In fact, I was so stoical when I heard that line about she was killed that I stood there and this detective woman said to me, are you okay? And I guess she thought I was going to cry or I was going to collapse or I was going to do something. And I said that I was. And she said something to the effect of, you seem so calm. And I said, well, that's because I'm acting. It's like, I don't know what else to do. I get what death is. I get what murder is. I'm just trying to imagine how anybody gets so mad they do something like that.
You're in shock.
Yes. It's on that list of the last things you ever want to hear. But that was that. So I then went home. I called my wife back, talked about it. She immediately came to the house. I didn't tell her what it was about. In fact, she decided, we're coming home right now. And I called my parents who I'd seen earlier and they came over and they were in their 80s. So they had to like get out of the pajamas, back in their clothes and go. This is like 9:30 at night on a Friday and it's raining dark. And that's when I told them all in the family room, this is what we've got. So the next day is all about visiting cemeteries, going to funeral homes, making arrangements. I mean, it's ridiculous. And fielding calls from detectives and from the people at the apartment complex where it happened, going through all that. Obviously, the days after that were all about getting ready for a funeral and making, you know, picking out the cemetery plot for real and all those things. What are we going to dress her in? Everything. Anyway, so she's buried and, you know, a couple of weeks, I stayed away from work for a couple of weeks and went back and there were people who were there, one who actually said to me, pulled me aside and said, you know, somehow I thought you'd never come back to work. I said, what do you think I'm going to do? I mean, are you going to stay at home and cry or something? Sit in the cave somewhere and roll the rock over the door, you know? So anyway, you kind of go through at that point, you go through something called preliminary hearing, where they bring the guy in and they tell him, basically it's to have a judge sign a piece of paper that says, yes, this should actually go to court. So, you know, that it could be something very minor that came in right before you, and then you come in with this murder situation, and of course the judge is going to sign off. So we were told, you know, you don't really even need to come to this. It's just a formality more than anything in the case like this. And we said, no, we're going to be at every last thing, and we were. And then about a month and a half later was something called a formal arraignment. That's when they really say, this is exactly what you're charged for: first degree murder, second degree murder, and using a weapon and all these things. He actually, she was killed in, what happened to her actually happened, it started in the kitchen and it involved knives. So that's where it started. She actually passed away in her bedroom. But anyway, so that's that. And then there's a period of time when we're waiting to see when the case might start. We were told he'll probably plead guilty to a lesser charge of some kind, you know, so he doesn't do life potentially. There was something called a continuance, you know, like we're just about at the time when the case was supposed to start. And then they kind of called a timeout in effect for a continuance. So it dragged through the holidays at the end of the year into the next year, pretty much free fall. You don't know when it's going to start. And then finally they picked a date. The date they picked was actually would have been the day after the first anniversary of her getting killed. It would have been, she was killed on June 3rd. This was June 4th of the following year. But with having a new date, the guy that did it actually decided to go and do the plea, and he pled guilty to murder and would receive then 15 to 30 years. So he would do a minimum of 15 and a maximum of 30 is the deal. So,
wow.
And so there's, you know, I wrote a book, I should mention here, I wrote a book that's called When Dating Hurts. And I also have a website, When Dating Hurts, and I even have a podcast called When Dating Hurts. And I just say that because what I'm walking you through, the story of what happened is actually in the book, and it takes you through it. The book is not a boo-hoo piece. It's not, hey, everybody, why don't you have a big cry for Bill and his family? It never goes there. It never wants you to do that. The purpose of writing the book is actually to show that this can happen to anybody. You know, we're not some extraordinary case, or we're not something that you might think is kind of a typical domestic violence situation here. You know, and honestly, what most people think is typical or stereotypical, they're wrong anyway. There is no typical. You know, there's no, people tend to think that it happens in the worst neighborhoods, or it happens to certain ethnic groups, or whatever you can fit in that blank. You know, we can all draw that picture in our mind. Can happen to anybody. And that was probably one of the useful things about our situation, was that we didn't look anything like the stereotype, which was wrong anyway, the cliche.
Well, yeah, I mean, it doesn't matter what sex, what, you know, what color you are, what age you are.
Yes. It's just that you hear certain things, or you're sent somehow, you know, you have something in the recordings in your head that takes you to places that are just inaccurate, is all I can tell you. It's just really, and I don't mean because our case is different. I mean, I've studied this for 20 years. I know what I'm talking about. So anyway, so he got 15 to 30. If you do the math, that was 2005 that he did it, and he got 15 to 30. So he did his 15. And that means that at this point in time, there are actually annual parole reviews. People call them parole hearings. They're not hearings. Their reviews, parole reviews. And another thing that's kind of a misnomer or misunderstanding in people's minds is they think that if you appear and you do your testimony at one of those reviews, that you're talking about the guy that did it while he's sitting at the table over there listening. It's not like that. He's not there. He's in prison. You're in a whole different place in the state. In this case, it was Pennsylvania, Commonwealth of Pennsylvania. So you don't have that going on, but you still are under pressure. You have 1 hour to state your case. We've done three of these and he's still in. So, but it's a year to year thing. And do I think he'll do the full 30? No. Do I think he'll do as many as 25? I'll say probably, but it's not up to me. And nobody really knows, you know, it's up to the parole board every year. That's kind of that. You know, one of the things that was kind of the silver lining, I guess, to this nasty situation was that even in the first year, I was asked if I wanted to say some words back at her college during the next school year, the first semester back. And so I was asked if I wanted to get up and say a few words. And they were having a memorial service where everybody walks around the campus carrying candles and saying prayers in the chapel. So I said, well, I'd really like to get up and speak, yes. And I asked my wife, who usually stays away from that type of thing in terms of getting up and doing public speaking, she wanted to do it. My son, who was 17, wanted to get up. So each of us wrote our own parts, didn't share it with each other. And I also created about a 5 to 7 minute video so that I wanted people who were there to really get to know her, because a lot of people in the room would not. It was 200 or 300 people. And it was pretty impressive. It was a Monday night and the place was packed. And one of the things that was so great about that evening was it was the first instance of really getting in front of a large group of people and talking about not only what happened, but why things like this happened. Because leading into it, nobody at this house had any idea about why domestic violence takes place, you know, other than somebody got mad, somebody got hurt. So the other thing that happened, which was pretty interesting, it was pretty great, was that when others got up and spoke, they had a woman that came from Washington to get up and give the government's version of how bad this problem is and statistics and go to this website and call this number. She got up and she did a half an hour that felt like 2 hours of just facts and figures. And people very naturally are listening, but they're in and out of listening and they're moving in their seats. You can just hear, you know, little creaks and little noises and coughing. What I noticed was when my son, my wife, and I got up separately and spoke, the place was completely quiet. I mean, you really could hear a pin drop. And when it was finished, I heard all these things about how powerful that was, and you all should do more of that. And it's like, all of a sudden, we were starting to be positioned as kind of crusaders for this cause, for this whole dating abuse, dating violence, domestic violence, intimate partner violence thing. So I kind of came out of there feeling like, I don't know what our future is going to be. At that point, the guy was not in prison. He was in jail, but he wasn't in prison yet. But we have been asked over the years, and I would say at this point, I've kind of lost track, but between speeches given and interviews for TV, for podcasts, for radio, I've probably given 200 speeches or so. It has to be. So that's been good. It was about 10 years into it, so that would be 2015, when I went on to LinkedIn and I wrote some posts or articles. And they were all under the heading of how to prevent a parent's worst nightmare. And I just thought, I'm just going to see what kind of response I get. Wasn't a business-oriented thing, because LinkedIn is really kind of positioned against business. But I thought, just see what people say. You know, they're going to tell me, you know, why are you writing this article? It has nothing to do with selling products or, you know, how to use social media or anything. But the response wasn't a great big response. I just, of course, got a lot of likes or loves or whatever they had on there. But the comments were really strong. And one of them, after I had written about 12 of these articles, one of them said, why don't you stop writing these articles on LinkedIn and why don't you just go and write the book? Interesting. That was 2015. That was 10 years after she was killed. I was banging out these articles, which had no future, really, except to sit on LinkedIn. So I guess about 5 months after that, I thought, well, I've never written a book before, but I have got a little bit of a start with these articles. I wrote about those things I felt like writing about. So I kind of committed myself at the end of 2015 to writing the book, and I had no deadline. I figured I'd probably self-publish, which I did. So 4.5 years, well, the beginning of 2020, which is, if my math is any good, just over 4 years, I was ready to go. I had my cover figured out. The book's called When Dating Hurts. I had written this. It's 320 pages. I felt good. I had a I hired an editor to kind of look through it and tell me where I was right or wrong. I think she was pretty gentle on me. And I had it all ready to go, and then COVID. And I thought, if I push the button in February or March with this COVID thing coming in, nobody's thinking about buying some book from a first-time author about, I don't even know what you're talking about stuff. You know, I don't know what dating violence is. You know, most people I used to talk about in the beginning about dating violence thought it was some version of bullying, which makes sense in a way. You know, it just didn't make sense. What do you mean dating violence? Like, two people are in love and they're violent?
How do people not know about that?
They just don't. They just don't. And quite frankly, quite a few people don't want to hear about it and don't want to know about it.
Well, that's, I'd say most people don't.
They don't think it applies. They don't think it applies to them. And I can speak about that. But anyway, finally, in late April of 2020 is when I pushed the button on Amazon and sat back like, okay, see what happens. And thank God the books has sold. So I did the book as a paperback. I did it as an ebook. And I waited for a while and I thought, well, I'd like to do it as an audiobook. I didn't know too much about how to create that. So I talked with people who actually did voice work. And I kept thinking, how weird is it to have a book that's written in the first person where I'm saying, I did this and I did that and we did this and she called me and I did. And I've got some guy who's a polished voiceover guy, you know, who does audiobooks, is going to sit there and he's going to what? He's going to be me? You know, I just thought that was just too weird.
Right.
And I was actually, it's funny, I talked with a few people. They said, well, the only piece of advice I have for you is don't you do it. And I said, why? And they said, well, because you won't get it finished. You'll be frustrated. You're not going to want to listen to your own voice. I got all these reasons. But anyhow, I thought, well, look, I'll go and I'll record a few chapters and I'll just see what happens. And I thought it sounded okay. And I let others hear it. And they said, so you're doing the book. That's great. You know, they didn't even know I was testing myself. I got that done. And that was good. So that came out. That came out in the very beginning of 2021. And it was based upon speaking that much and editing it that much. I had to edit quite a lot. You know, you do a sentence over and over till you get it the way you want it. I started thinking, well, the book is kind of done in all flavors. And then I thought, I felt like I had lost a good friend. I'd spent 4 years with this project. And once it's published, you know, you don't rewrite a book. It's gone. It's out. You know, it's not going to change. It's out. Done. So I thought, well, what if I did a podcast? And I thought, boy, you know, I don't know, you know, who's going to want to come on my podcast? Who's going to want to listen to this thing? So I actually started by interviewing people I had met who were people who worked on the case or people who were domestic violence directors and counselors that I had met over the years, because I had met so many. I'd given these speeches. I met all these people who were subject matter experts, much more than I was. So that's who really appears on the podcast in the very beginning. And it's been around now for just over 3 years. And I can tell you, it's kind of timely that we're speaking, because the podcast, which has been around 3 years and 2 months, sometime in the next month or so, I calculate it'll hit 1 million downloads total. So I never saw that day coming. And I have to say, I've watched the numbers over the course of time, but I never would have ever pictured somewhere in any future that would hit one with all those zeros and commas. So that's coming up, you know?
Yeah.
But, you know, it's not so much an ego trip. It's more about the fact that that means it's been downloaded and hopefully listened to that many times by a lot of different people. And therefore, the word's gotten out. And for the last year and a half, good, strong year and a half, I have been soliciting survivors to come on and speak and tell their stories. Now, in the beginning, when I asked the domestic violence agency people if they could find me survivors who would step forward and just anonymously, on audio only, tell their stories, the answer coming back was they really didn't even want to ask them. They thought that this is the most horrible part of their lives, why would they want to go on and relive the entire story from I grew up with my mom and dad and my sister and my brother, and then one day I met this guy, and then we were dating, and he seemed really nice, and everybody thought, oh my God, you're dating him, that's so great. And then you start to see the bad behavior, you know, you see the warning signs, the bad behavior, it gets worse and worse, and for some reason that seems to be inexplicable, she stays in the relationship. You know, that's the skeletal version of just about every one of those stories.
Hi, I'm Ashley, a true crime fanatic.
I'm Dan, and I don't know anything about true crime.
Together, we host Fuck That, a true crime podcast that covers cases that highlight important topics that are often overlooked, such as wrongful convictions, domestic violence, and social inequities, sprinkled in with the occasional case with spooky themes. If you are looking for your next true crime fix delivered candidly with a hint of sarcasm, you can listen and subscribe to bi-weekly episodes of Fuck That wherever you listen to your podcasts. And don't forget to give us a follow on Facebook and Twitter at FThatPod and at FThat_pod on Instagram.
But anyway, I was on a couple really large podcasts, bigger than a million downloads, more like 10 times that. I was asked to come on, and at the end would say, go to my website, listen to my podcast. And that's actually how I started to get more and more audience members, by being on other people's shows. So it's a little secret I learned. And I just, that's all of a sudden my numbers started to really go up. And of course, if you have the content and the delivery and the guests, then you can keep people and you can get more people, because obviously word of mouth plays a big part of it.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And that's what I have on my show too, survivors and professionals.
Yeah. Well, it's all about, I mean, it's all the basic stuff, you know, for podcasters. It has to be something that one way or another seems to apply to the wants and desires of listeners, because you could have the best of intentions, but if you're not interesting, you don't hold attention, you don't do what I call rewarding people for staying around, you know, the stories have to move or whatever you're talking about. You know, it's all the basic stuff, which is, although so basic, is not necessarily so easy to deliver on those things. You know, you can't just make yourself interesting, poof, you know, like that. You have to kind of have it, you know. And I've been very fortunate, because the survivors, I interviewed someone just this afternoon, and they're so articulate. They tell in such detail the most horrible stuff. You know, I kind of promised myself when I started to interview survivors that whatever they said, it's kind of like, if you say it, I'll print it, you know? So I felt if you had enough courage to say it, I should have enough courage to play it. I didn't mean for that to rhyme, but it did actually. But that's kind of that. And I thought one of the things that might be useful, actually, I know it will be useful to our audience, is that, you know, once in a while, maybe in your life, you hear somebody saying, well, you know, you really should learn the warning signs of an unhealthy relationship. And even on our own show, we'll talk about, well, you know, like somebody will say, you know, what is the one thing that you would, when I give a talk afterwards, somebody might ask a question like, what's the one thing that, if I don't remember anything about tonight, what should I remember? And I'll say, well, you should remember to get in touch with the warning signs and listen to them, and then keep your eyes open, because they can kind of appear. And if you don't know what you're looking for, then when it happens, you'll not catch on. You know, you won't go, whoa, whoa, wait a minute. That's what that guy was talking about, or that's what that book was talking about, and that's what that domestic violence person. So without further ado, I thought it made sense to kind of just go through a list. I have a list of 12, which I'll try to move through kind of briskly so people can back it up a couple times if I'm going too fast. But the key to it, if you don't remember anything else, the umbrella that all of these fit under are under the umbrella of power and control over another person. One person exerting power and control over another person. Now, if you've never had it happen to yourself, or if you've never been around somebody who's had it happen, it's kind of like, well, I don't know. What are you talking about? You know, what is that? What does that even look like? And I'll give you examples, but controlling or dominant behavior that starts to permeate someone's life. Now, let's just say for a moment that two people meet, wherever it is, high school, college, work, you name it, library, grocery store, but they kind of like lock eyes, you know, and they're kind of interested. Could be a man and a woman, could be two guys, could be two women. And in this case, the bad guy in the story, you know, could be a man or a woman, you know. Now, the most typical thing, and it is typical, at least once it starts marching itself into physical abuse, it's usually men getting physical to women. You know, that's it.
Goes both ways, though.
But it's tilted way far over. I mean, it's kind of a 90 to 10, 95 to 5. But just in terms of like emotional abuse, it's pretty 50-50, like even in high school. So that's interesting, I think. And it starts with emotional. I don't think I've yet heard, I'm sure there are examples, but I don't think I've yet heard of anybody who started out slapping or punching somebody, you know, in the very beginning. So in fact, one of the things I always find myself saying is that if somebody acted on the first date like they acted on the 30th date, that relationship wouldn't last to a second date. But let me go through this. Controlling or dominant behavior that starts to permeate someone's life. And I'll go through some of these and you'll see what I mean. But now imagine again, you picture this couple. And let's say the guy is the bad actor in this story, the person who will emerge slowly but surely as the abusive person. And the other person, unfortunately, is the victim of what's going on. So again, it doesn't usually start out this way, but over the course of time, the abuser will show extreme jealousy or possessiveness about who that other person sees and what they're doing. Okay, so it's like, well, and it can start off innocent, like, well, you know, I thought on Saturday it would kind of just be you and me, and you're going to go see them. I mean, you see them all week, you know. I thought, you know, and you're thinking, well, I know, but we're in school. This is different. You know, we want to go to the mall for a few hours. You know, so it's like somebody who's just like pretty much wants to take over a lot of your time. Another one can be isolating you from family, friends, and the things you like to do. And isolation, wow, it comes up in every one of these. And that's similar to what I told you a second ago, which is like, geez, I really want you to be with me. I don't want you to be so much with these other people. Now, it starts off and it sounds like, wow, he must really like me. You know, he just wants to spend all of his time with me. Well, there's two sides to that coin, because the other side of the coin is he wants to spend all his time with you, but he wants you to spend all your time with him and nobody else. Friends or family or anybody, okay? And it doesn't start that way, but it will keep going that way. And that's why you have to know these things. Somebody maybe who gets into name-calling or putting you down about how you look or what you wear. It's maybe not even so much about what you're wearing. It's just putting you down. When you put somebody down, you're putting them in a certain place. You're putting them in a very secondary place in the relationship. You're making them a bit subservient to you. Somebody who maybe is constantly checking up on you with text messages and phone calls. This woman I spoke with this afternoon, I mean, it was over the top. People use the expression nowadays, he was blowing up my phone. I don't know if you've heard that one.
I have.
Yeah. Blowing up my phone. I think it's even a lot of songs have that line in there. But that's what that is. It's like, oh my God, I just got two more text messages.
Yeah, when you look down and you got like 68, that's a sign. That's a problem.
That's really true. Yeah, and I know that's a really big number. It sounds ridiculous, but unfortunately, it can happen just like that. Or he's ringing me again. You know, it's like, and the guy's on the phone is like, you said you'd be at the mall an hour and a half or so. It's already 2 hours. What's going on? You know, versus like, why don't you get busy with something else and let this person have some space? Which is, this is one of the things that happened with my daughter, this isolation bit. Making you feel nobody else would ever want or love you. Again, it doesn't necessarily happen in the beginning. It's just the wearing down process of one person over another person. That's the power and control. I'm going to keep emotionally beating you down until the only person that I will allow you to be around is me, you know, because you're just weak at that point. Somebody making you feel you cannot do anything right, keeping you off balance. So every time you make any kind of mistake at all, it's like, oh my God, you did that again. What are you, stupid? You know, what's going on with you? You know, what? I don't get it. And then start telling you all the things you've done wrong. Well, that eats away at your self-esteem. You know, your power and control at this point is going way down. It's like the fuel gauge in your car, except it's going real fast, going the wrong way, making you feel that maybe you're going crazy. You know, so that kind of goes a little bit hands in hand with the last one. And that's one that sometimes you hear referred to as gaslighting. I don't know if your audience has heard that, but that goes back to some 1939 movie where this guy was trying to convince his wife that she was crazy and have her committed. And then he was going to take over her mother's money. Her mother had passed and she had all this money. And you should see it. It's a good movie. Anyway.
Sounds great.
Yeah. I didn't sell it very well. Somebody who's lying about practically everything that has happened or will happen. You get to that point where it's like, man, that doesn't ring true. Where were you? Or it's just like, you come to find out, like, you don't have all this money. You know, I just heard you don't have all this money. You told me you had all this money, or you told me you won this award, or whatever that is, or you're not a straight A student. You know, just somebody who keeps doing that. Love bombing, I mentioned that a minute ago, but love bombing is all about, especially in the early stages, somebody who's just always bringing the goodies. You know, now, depending on what age you are, if you're 14 years old, you probably don't have a big wallet with a lot of money in it. But as time goes on, if somebody who's maybe in college or in their 20s, you know, somebody who's taking you out to places you've never been before, and maybe it's like, wow, you just bought me the newest iPhone. This is great. You know, this is wonderful. But these over the top words of love, you know, it's like, oh my God, you know, I've never been in love so much as somebody like you. That goes hand in hand with the next one, which is someone who speeds up all facets of the relationship and maybe even projects you having a big future together. It's not a bad thing if somebody tells you that he loves you. It just is kind of curious if you've been dating for a week or two. That's what I'm talking about, speeding up.
Red flag.
Big red one. And projecting, you know, oh my God. I heard of this one young woman. They've been dating for a week or two, and he'd refer to her as Mrs. And then he'd have his last name in there. So Mrs. Johnson or whatever. So Mrs. Johnson, what do you want to do today? So he's already projecting, you know, you and me, that's it. Stop looking. You know, this is the best you're going to do right here. You know, you and me, everything but the ring. Somebody, as I mentioned before, keeping you off balance, making you feel you're going crazy. You know, that type of thing. All kinds of terms I've run into, and I'll give you some of them and I'll explain some of them. But yeah, I just said gaslighting, which again goes back to finding, and in some cases, actually contriving things in such a way you'll think you're crazy. I had a relative of mine I spoke with. It's actually one of my cousin's daughters, who's married to a guy. They had three boys. And she used to go down at the end of the day, everybody's off the bed, but she'd go down to the kitchen. She kind of put everything out and vitamins and all these things. And then this guy had all these little tricks, but she came finally to find out, okay, so the symptom is the next day she'd come down and some of the vitamins and things like that aren't even out anymore. And she'd say, what happened here? I came down last night. I put all these things out. They're not even out. And he's like, well, I guess you didn't put them out. Well, that's because he slipped down afterwards when she was in the bathroom and he put some of them away. So she'd think she was going crazy and almost had her convinced.
Wow.
That's a dilly, right?
Yeah. I haven't heard that one.
Yeah, it's pretty bad. Well, they're not together anymore. So that's happy.
Well, good.
Happy ending to that. Pocketing is another one. Pocketing's interesting. Pocketing is when I want you to, or I don't want you to meet all my friends. I'm going to have a lot of friends. I don't, by the way, don't want you to have any friends, but I'll have a lot of friends, but I'm never going to bring you around them as if I'm keeping you in my pocket. That's why it's called that. Futuring is always talking about things that we're going to do, and I see us doing that. You know, next summer, I want us to do this and all these wonderful things that will never, ever happen. But it's keeping that carrot dangling in front of you. There's one called hoovering. If you'd heard that one, that's fairly new to me. Hoovering. And my next thought, I actually originally thought it was hovering, but it's hoovering.
That's what I was thinking.
And it's called hoovering because of the vacuum cleaners, the Hoover.
And so it sucks up stuff.
in this case, is every time you get away, they suck you back in. That's why it's called hoovering. Now, and there's one called trauma bonding. That doesn't really probably appear so much in high school or college, but let's say somebody's in their 20s, 30s, and later, because this can happen at any point, you know, this domestic violence stuff can happen at any point. But trauma bonding is interesting because what will happen oftentimes is that the offender, you know, the abuser has all these problems and maybe is really awful. And the other person feels like, wow, if I could just somehow stick with this person and just get them back to how wonderful they were in the very beginning. And that becomes the relationship. In this example we keep using, she's trying to help him get back. She's trying to mend him. You know, he's maybe explained he had a rough upbringing, whether he did or not, by the way, that he had a rough upbringing. And that's why he does some of the things he does. And if she could just embrace him and get him through this, you know, so that becomes the bond. You treat me like garbage and I treat you great because I'm trying to save you. And the last one on our list is probably my favorite one. And believe it or not, it's called flying monkeys. Flying monkeys goes back to the Wizard of Oz. So what did the witch do in the Wizard of Oz? She had these flying monkeys. And so rather than her go out and make the Scarecrow and the Tin Man and Dorothy and the Lion, rather than her go and make them miserable, she'd get the flying monkeys all going, you know, like a crowd of, like, it's like the main bully getting his guys going and sends them out to do the dirty work for her. Okay. In this case, it's when you have an abuser who gets his friends, or could be male or female friends, you know, who just kind of like buy into his story and the way that he wants to treat somebody, and they go do it, so that you're not only being abused by the abuser, you're also being abused by the abuser's buddies. So they're also putting you down because you spoke too loud to him, or, you know, this kind of thing. They're kind of defending his position.
And I'd like to throw out one about if a man will not let you save money, always wants you to spend money, or refuses to work, that is financial abuse.
Financial abuse.
If you cannot put money away so you can have something, if they're constantly needing you to take things, then absolutely that's financial abuse, because they don't want you to have the money to be able to leave.
Yes. And the financial abuse, you know, this again, these people who do this get to be rather practiced at it. There is on my When Dating Hurts podcast, there is an episode I put out really only 3 or 4 weeks ago, and it'll say it in the description about financial abuse, but it's a woman who married a guy and they were married for about 15 years. But from the very beginning, even right before they got married, he was finding all kinds of ways to get into her financial life and mess with it. And for instance, like if she took out student loans, he would somehow figure out ways to get his hands on the money and spend it on himself. And by the time that came to a screeching halt, he had also posed as he actually started, this is amazing stuff I know, started some version of a church and was the minister. So he could take all kinds of money that he would get from all kinds of people. He wouldn't pay the bills so much as he would just buy himself junk, toys, whatever he was doing. But it's at one point he came to her and he said, look, you know, the church is really in trouble. And what I'd like to do is take out a home equity loan, you know, on the house and use that money to basically put out this financial fire at the church. And she said, I don't think so. And so she got all mad and they had this argument. It's like, I don't understand why you're not doing this. You know, come on, you know. And she said, look, I'm just going to go take a walk. Let me take a walk and think about this. And what happened to her, she thought, you know, this is so weird that he's doing this. I just wonder if has he been doing other stuff? I mean, he's been kind of over there taking care of the financial stuff, and I'm doing other things. I mean, she was a professor at a college. You know, she wasn't just staying home doing nothing. I mean, she was active and doing things. And well, once she started digging, it really got bad. I mean, she got to the point where she got federal investigators in there. I mean, she called them all in. They were swarming. But by the time the dust settled, since her name was on quite a few credit cards and a lot of other things, she is still working her way out of literally hundreds of thousands of dollars in debt that he put on her that she can't get.
She can't prove that he's the one who did it?
It would be wow. Like it would be like if you and I were some version of an item and you get a credit card and then we get a second one in my name and I keep going crazy on that credit card, but it's really your credit card.
I see.
Or if, okay. I have your credit card and I go on Amazon and I buy a bunch of stuff, you know, here are my toys. They just came in the box and guess what? You can pay for them. So.
Right. Well,
he was much more undercover than that one, because that would be exposed the first month. He was quite good at it. I mean, 15 years doing this stuff. You know, he was, as I say oftentimes, very good at being bad. Very good at it.
Yes, they define their craft. That's for sure.
So I'll share one more thing, unless you have questions, but it's pretty quick compared to some of the things we've had to work our way through. There is something that there's a light that came on in my head some years ago, hearing a lot of different stories. And I thought about it and I thought, I wonder if there's some kind of a template that every abuser follows, kind of a playbook. And I realized there really is. And it goes like this. There's only five parts to it. Part one, I mentioned a little bit before, is storybook romance. It's that fairy tale beginning. They don't all start that way, but a lot of them start that way. It's like, oh my God, I met the most wonderful guy. You know, I can't believe it. You know, we've gone out a couple of times. I mean, he seems to appreciate me more than I felt from other people. He seems to want to do some of the things that I'm doing. Some of them he hasn't done before, but he says, look, I'd like to learn that. I mean, seems to like the same kind of music. By the way, that's called mirroring. It's another term. It's somebody who maybe has never even heard that group, but is going to hurry up and get that CD and listen to it. You know, just, you know, it's kind of like becoming another version of you, but that's mirroring. But anyhow, storybook romance in the beginning. Wow, I'm going to places I've never been before. He's spending money on me. I go to work the next day because we went out on a Tuesday night. I went to work the next day. There's two bouquets sitting there for me. I couldn't believe it. Everybody's like, wow, who are you going out with? I was like, I know there's this guy. He's like this prince. That's number one. Number two, we mentioned isolation. Doesn't happen the first night, but it's things like, you know, really not that crazy about your parents, you know, once he meets them. You know, I don't know. I don't think your parents like me very much. I'd be happier to spend less time with them. And to tell you the truth, you know, your brother's, I think your brother's kind of a jerk, you know? I mean, I have nothing in common with him. So over the course of time, he's not going to like your friends. He's not going to like a whole lot of things, and he's going to try to isolate you. But again, it doesn't get dumped on you at the first week. So number one, fairy tale romance. Number two, isolation. Number three is threats of violence. Threats of violence can come in a lot of different flavors, but one of them is just somebody who really gets angry. And you're thinking, whoa, whatever I just did, he really didn't like. I don't want to see that get any worse. I better comply. I better go along with this guy. You know, I kind of liked him two steps ago. Threats of violence could be, you know, I got to tell you something. When you said what you said, it reminded my mother how she used to talk with me. And I didn't put up with her, and I'm not going to put up with that stuff with you. So that's a kind of a threat of like, whoa, you know, this, we got to watch it. Her slams on the brakes. You almost put your head into the dashboard because you said or did something or you brought up something he doesn't want to talk about. So these are like, whoa, okay. So that's a threat of violence. Violence is violence, you know, actual violence. And we could be talking about somebody who gives you a pretty hard shove, punches you in the arm, punches you in the stomach, shoves you into something, throws something big and heavy at you. I know of people who've been shoved down a flight of steps, you know, how they lived through that. I don't know exactly. Somebody who might strangulate you. I just interviewed somebody today who had that happen at one point. I mean, completely shutting off her breathing ability, you know, so it's pretty terrifying. What comes after that, though, is the next step, which is what's called convincing apology. Look, I am so sorry about that whole thing. You know, I was having a bad week. You know, I've worked there for 5 years. I started that at that place the same week as Jim. And then they had called this meeting in the conference room. He's now a vice president of the company, has a whole different healthcare thing. He gets to park on a different lot. I mean, I've done a lot more work than that guy. I never see him there after work. I'm there all the time. So I lost it. I'm sorry. You know, it wasn't about you. It'll never happen again. It hasn't happened before. You know, can't we just move on with this thing? And if the person who's being abused buys that, thinks about it like, well, I guess if we can get back to that wonderful part of the relationship, she's maybe thinking, or whoever's being abused, be nice to get back there. And all of a sudden, whoa, magic, we're back to the first part, because it's a cycle. We're going to be really, really nice, and we're going to do nice things, and I'm going to buy you stuff, and it's really going to be cool. I'm going to isolate you some more to the point where one day you're going to feel like there's absolutely nobody else in your life but me. There are going to be other threats of violence. You know, I get really loud. I smash something someday. I'm screaming at your dog or whatever that is. You know, more violence, more apologies. You finally get to the point with the apologies where the apologies are actually getting smaller and smaller, because you can't keep saying it's the first time this has ever happened when it's like the 20th. Sometimes convincing apology only is he stopped doing whatever he was doing, and there's peace in the land for a little bit of time. I'll take the peace. I'll do anything to stop the craziness and have peace, you know, while I'm getting the broom to sweep up what just broke on the kitchen floor over there. But it's awful. It's very, very sad. And the idea of doing this is to try to catch people with the warning signs and everything we've been talking about here for a while, and get them to the point where they say, okay, I'm going to pay attention to this type of stuff. And if I see it, especially in my own relationships, I'm going to get out of that relationship. If I see it happen to my friend, I'm going to say to my friend, look, we need to go see a domestic violence counselor or a psychologist, or we're going to call a national helpline, like the National Domestic Violence Helpline, you know, at the hotline, which is 800-799-SAFE is their number, the national line. And we're going to get some counseling, and we're going to do something. And if it's happening to a friend, say, look, why don't we do this? Why don't we sit on the phone together? You don't have to just sit there, and we'll talk to this person. And if you get to the point where you don't want to talk anymore, we'll get off. We'll hang up. We'll say goodbye. They're not going to send a SWAT team. Nothing big's going to happen, but we need to start moving in the right direction. But I'll finish by saying that someone who's being abused will not be out of that relationship until they want totally to be out of that relationship. They have to bottom out. They have to say, I just can't do that. Some people get there right away. I've talked with people who have unfortunately been on the receiving end for multiple decades. And why is that? Because maybe they have kids. Maybe they're financially tied up. And maybe there are all kinds of other reasons. But we want them to pay attention so that when this type of thing is happening around them, they say, oh my God, it's one of those. I got to get out of this. I'm going to get some counseling. I need to get away from this person and get out of town.
Absolutely. You've got to look at the warning signs. And actually, on my website, True Crime Connections, I also have the hotlines and all that good stuff there in case anybody needs to find that number again.
Oh, that's fabulous. I'm glad you're doing that.
Absolutely.
Sure.
Where do you want people to come and find you if they would like? Are you on all podcast platforms?
I am, yes. Yeah, the When Dating Hurts podcast is on. If you can think of it, it's on there. You know, people typically go to Apple Podcasts, or they go to Spotify or Google. You know, so it's very easy to find. And if you want to know more about what I'm doing, go to whendatinghurts.com, and you can find the podcast through there. You can see some videos. You'll see my daughter on there. You know, you'll see some things that you'll see a lot of things that we've done. I mentioned those warning signs. They're all on there also. So if you wanted to get to that page or print it out, maybe and hang on to it and maybe share it with other people. You know, I think it's great. It's great that you're doing a podcast about this subject because we have to make it easy for people to get to this information. And we have to convince people that it can happen to anyone. I should tell you, I'm glad I didn't forget to do this. The only statistic that I ever use is this next one. And that is that 1 in 3 women will suffer serious physical violence at the hands of an intimate partner at some point in their lifetime. And that it typically happens to women between the ages of 16 and 24, but can happen to any woman at any age. And I mean, I've met 12-year-olds who've had the whole menu of things that can happen. And I talk with a woman who was in her late 60s who just got divorced. I mean, she had 40-plus years of this from this man. You know, they were just so financially and everything tied together with kids and grandkids and all that. And she would just take the hits and you know, go off and put some ice on it, I guess, and wait it out until she could appear back in public. I mean, she really quite a saint, you know, from that standpoint, putting up with that and just trying to keep the family together and just suffering being the victim. But she's out at this point. So took a long time.
Painful to hear that for sure. Yeah. You don't have to live like that. There are options. There are resources. So.
Yes. And honestly, too, if you're going through something like this, your friends don't know enough to help you. They can feel bad. They can show sympathy and empathy, but they don't know this subject. And your parents don't know this subject as well-meaning as they might be if you share this with them. They don't know all the twists and turns. And there are a lot of mistakes that can be made in trying to extricate somebody from one of these relationships. These relationships, by the way, as you well know, Tiffany, is that breaking up is the most dangerous time. And my daughter was breaking up with this guy when, unfortunately, she was breaking up with him around 2 or 3 in the morning in her apartment, just the two of them. I mean, it was just like, it's exactly the wrong thing to do. And she was killed. So there's a lot to be learned. You know, and that's one of the things I do feel good about was that I didn't want her legacy to be, wow, what a shame. She did 4 years in college, had a job lined up with General Mills, and then gets killed by her boyfriend, period. What a legacy. Versus, yes, that's what happened, but I feel that her legacy is that her story interests people enough to stick around to find out how this happened, why this happened, when it happened, where it happened, how to detect these kinds of relationships, how to break free from these relationships, how to have a safer life, how to create an escape plan, safety plan to get out, which, by the way, do it again with a domestic violence agency, somebody who knows what they're talking about, not with your best friend, not with your parents. Right. Because the people who do that stuff for a living, people who craft those plans, or looking at it like you're 18 or you're 28 or whatever you are, or you're married and you're financially tied together, those escape plans are all very different, or the kind of behavior you're dealing with. These escape plans have to be extremely different. I mean, you may have to leave in the cover of night. You know, there's some people who are, I talked with a woman today, she was in California one day and she was in Florida the next day and he didn't know where she went. Poof. Just like a cloud of smoke and exit.
It's the way to do it.
And she's still alive. Can. He threatened to kill her many times. Yes. Yes. So, but yeah, head to whendatinghurts.com and you'll find some of the things that I've got waiting for you there.
Perfect.
And listen to the podcast if you have time.
Yes.
Make time.
Thank you for being here. I appreciate it.
You're welcome. Yeah, this is wonderful. I wish you the best. I think you have a great podcast.